Hi, my name is Cecilia Pounin, and welcome to this episode of Brave New Women. All around the world, there are amazing, ordinary women doing extraordinary things. Brave New Women is about giving those women a platform and a voice, and it's about changing the way that women are perceived. And it's a way of inspiring all of us to do the things that we've always wanted to do.
It's a great pleasure for me to welcome Donna Lawler to the podcast. Now, Donna is a space lawyer, and 2 years ago, she set up a company called Azimuth Advisory. So, Donna, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Cecilia, and it's delightful to be here with you.
And Donna, my first question is, what is a space lawyer?
Oh, that's an interesting question, and I will answer it with a story. When I first started at a telecommunications company called Optus as an in-house lawyer, I was told that I would be in charge of the satellite business from the legal side. And so for the next few years, well, actually for the next 20 years, I did the legal work for that satellite business, which entailed buying satellites and launching satellites, selling services on satellites. But I didn't, for a long time, I didn't actually call what I did space law. I wasn't aware that there was such a cool label for it. And it wasn't until sometime later that I found some guy online that was calling himself a space lawyer that I realized, hang on a second, if anyone's a space lawyer, it's me. I'm the only one in Australia. So I sent that guy an email saying, who the hell are you? I'm the only space lawyer in the village. And that turned out to be Professor Stephen Freeland, whom I ended up marrying.
And that's a great story.
His version of a space lawyer was more, I think, space law was more to do with international space law. So he is an international law expert, and he's with a particular expertise in space law. And I'm at the more commercial side. So I happen to be a lawyer who helps companies with space activities. And that's my version of space law.
Mm-hmm. And so what does a space lawyer do every day? What, you know, in your version of space law, what do you do every day?
Well, we have clients in government and in commerce and universities, all of whom are involved in space activities. So we are working with companies who are looking at setting up launch facilities or are looking to launch rockets, or are looking to, or are launching and operating constellations of small satellites for Internet of Things, or constellations of huge satellites for telecommunications. And then we have some other clients that are involved in some more exotic areas. So, for example, we have one who's preparing a lunar mission.
Wow.
One who is preparing a space tug. And another one is who's looking at manufacturing items in space, as well as we have another client that is technology for extracting water resources from the moon. So 2 days ago, NASA announced that it's found more water on the moon than they thought, and our client will be well positioned to help them find that water.
Wow. And so the contracts, I mean, is it mostly buying and selling? I mean, is it buying and selling contracts, or is it?
I guess it is mostly buying or selling of some form, but there's always a space aspect to that. So, and then another angle that is mostly my husband Stephen that works to advise governments. So we have worked with 9 different governments so far, assisting them and advising them on regulation of space activities.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'd like to hear more about the regulation of space activities, because I mean, I imagine it's a bit like the high seas, you know, the law of the high seas. And, you know, space doesn't belong to anybody.
Yes.
And so how is that all regulated?
Yeah, space, like the high seas, is an area beyond national jurisdiction. So all the countries in the world have agreed, or most countries in the world have agreed to the Magna Carta of space law, which is the Outer Space Treaty. And under that treaty, there is a very strong agreement that no nation will claim sovereignty over outer space. And so there is still a discussion about whether or not space is a global commons, which is my view, and which I believe is the view of most nations, or whether it belongs to no one, which is a sort of the space equivalent of terra nullius. And I think there are certainly some strong lobby groups in the United States that are seeking to push that particular view, that it belongs to no one and therefore they need no one's permission in order to extract resources, for example.
So if it's a global commons, does that mean that everybody needs to look after it? Whereas if it's a terra nullius, that means that you can just do whatever you like. Is that the distinction between?
Yes. I think there is a perception that it's the wild, wild west and you can do whatever you like. That's actually definitely incorrect. There are laws about protecting the fragile environment of space. There are laws about having due regard to other participants in space. So it's clear that there is law regardless of which view prevails, but the more pressing issue that is just coming into focus now is the use and extraction and exploitation of resources on the moon and asteroids and elsewhere in space. And the question there is does there need to be some form of multilateral international supervision of those activities and some form of licensing or governance over those activities, or is it just a free-for-all and anyone can go and just the first come, first serve, and you can just take the resources when you find them? And so that's being discussed at the moment at the United Nations, and there is a working group that will be discussing potential rules that might apply to that. But those issues, because things are done on a consensus basis at the United Nations Committee for the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, it takes a long time to reach agreement. But I think now there is a renewed sense of urgency because there's a recognition that it won't be too long before people start going there, private companies even start going and starting to extract resources. And then the question is, are the companies that are not the first there, will everything be gone by the time they get there? Will they receive any benefits from that? Or will it just be the fastest and the richest?
When you talk about resources, are we talking about resources from the moon or from other planets, or where are the resources coming from?
Well, I think the most obvious starting point is the moon. So, as I mentioned, there is more water on the moon, billions of tons of water, than we expected. Mm-hmm. Not all of that will be accessible. So it could be that some of it is very hard to get and some of it is more easy to get. So there still may be a race to get the easiest deposits. The water is useful for both for supporting a potential settlement on the moon, but also for use as fuel for another push to get to Mars. So some long, deep spacefaring vehicles use water as propulsion.
Okay.
So it's a desirable, it's very expensive to carry water to the moon from Earth, but we'll see whether or not there is an economic case for using it in situ on the moon, and then whether the people of the Earth are prepared to give that either a social license or some other form of international written license to do so.
Mm-hmm. And what's actually up there at the moment? I mean, what's circling around the earth? What's up there?
Oh, there are probably about 7,000 objects. I may have that wrong, but my recollection is that there's about 7,000 objects. About 1,500 of those would be in geostationary orbit, and then there are a lot of other objects at low Earth orbits. The geostationary orbit ones would be 36,000 kilometres away, so that's very, very far. And that's where the communication satellites are that appear to stay perfectly still relative to the area of the Earth that they're over.
The geostationary, so that would mean if they're launched above the Siberian desert, then they stay above the Siberian desert.
They're all above the equator, so it's a perfect circle around the equator. But if they're above that part of the Earth, they'll stay where they are. And they have to fire their little thrusters every couple of weeks to keep themselves there. Otherwise, gravity of the moon and the sun will pull them off course. And then there's a whole lot of other much, much further down, so 300 kilometres away, 400 kilometres away, 500 kilometres away, you'll find constellations of small satellites. You'll find the International Space Station. And then you'll find a whole lot of debris, including debris from anti-satellite weapons testing by China and more recently India. The United States also tested a weapon. I think hopefully most of that debris has been deorbited. But so the militarization of space is something that is also one of the issues that is of interest and of concern to people who are interested in the uses of space for humankind.
So how would that work? Would it be something that's shooting up into space, shooting down from space, shooting other people's satellites?
Oh, maybe all of the above, interfering. So there's if you think about the way the United States, for example, uses space to give itself an advantage, the United States' military superiority would not be nearly so great if they did not have space resources for information, communications, for targeting things, for observing things. And so all of the major military powers rely very heavily on space to give themselves an advantage. And so what that means is if you want to remove the advantage of your adversary, you might want to interfere with their ability to use space, either by interfering with their satellites or cyber attacking, or even if you're completely irresponsible, engaging in a kinetic attack against another satellite, either from the ground or even from another satellite. You could move another satellite, just crash it into, or fire something from, or you know, there's lasers, there's all kinds of things that people are looking at. So part of the purpose for the Committee for the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, is to continually maintain the importance of using space for peaceful purposes. So there are legal commitments in the Outer Space Treaty about not putting weapons into orbit and not putting nuclear weapons into orbit, and weapons of mass destruction. And then there is a general understanding that the use of space is for peaceful purposes, but there's no absolute prohibition on weapons in space. There is a prohibition about weapons on the moon, which is separate.
What would you actually do if somebody put, I don't know, the US or Russia or one of our country started putting weapons on their satellites, nuclear weapons on their satellites? What would you do with that?
Well, if it was a clear breach, I suppose the only path is to take some sort of an action with the International Court of Justice. I mean, obviously there could be diplomatic efforts and for all we know there could be already nuclear weapons up there. But I don't think this is where I'm not an international law expert, but I don't think the United States recognises the jurisdiction of the ICJ. So that might be one problem. But you could certainly, for example, get a declaration from the ICJ that it's against, contrary to the law. So, for example, the ICJ has decided that China does not own, their claim to the South China Sea is not valid.
Mm-hmm. And how do things get deorbited? How do you bring something down from space?
Okay, well, it depends where it is to start with. So if you're one of the lower objects, then you would deorbit it by it's going to just burn up as soon as it hits the Earth's atmosphere, unless it's very large or unless the materials are very dense. So every now and then something does make it to the ground. You might remember the Skylab scare since you grew up in Australia like I did.
Yeah.
I was in year six when Skylab came back down to Earth in Australia, and NASA was actually issued with a littering fine by a local company. that's a bit of a joke. Most objects, however, burn up on the way down, so you don't need to worry and walk around with a big steel umbrella over your head. That's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking about the large geostationary objects that are 36,000 kilometres away, they can't come down. So there's no way they could get enough energy to come down. So if you want to, when they've finished their useful life and they're out of fuel, you usually would, the best practice is to save a bit of fuel and then push it out to space, not just out into space, into what's called a graveyard orbit. So it's still there. It'll be there for forever, but it's at least certainly within our lifetimes, but it's not going to crash into other objects in the geostationary orbit, or at least it minimises the likelihood of that. So so there is a responsible way to do it and a less responsible way. But I think the amount of debris that's up there and dead satellites is going to be one that increasingly we're going to have to look at very carefully, because if you look at, for example, Elon Musk's Starlink, they're planning to put 12,000 small satellites up there. They've actually registered 48,000 filings for spacecraft in the future. China wants to put up 3,000. Jeff Bezos wants to put up several thousand as well. So there are, and clients of ours, want to put up not in the thousands but in the hundreds. So there is increasingly attention on, gee, that's a lot of stuff. Can we really bear that much stuff in these orbits? Is it unfair for some countries to be hogging the useful orbits and taking up all the, it's actually ends up being spectrum is the limiting factor. What's going to happen when these things start crashing into each other? Do we need to make rules about rules of the road, so to speak? So space traffic is a big topic of discussion, both at the international level and also national governments are thinking about it too.
And what are all these satellites being used for? I mean, I know that they're being used for mobile phones, but and GPS and those sorts of things. But is that the main things they're being used for? Are there other?
There are many uses. So there's a whole range of communications and Internet of Things, less so mobile phones actually, because there's a bit of latency. The Elon Musk Starlink ones will be used to provide internet to every place on Earth. That's the plan, and there are others that are planning to do similar things. But there's also a lot of uses when it comes to collection of data about the Earth. So an awful lot of environmental data about climate change, about the weather, about agriculture, about You're able to get a lot of information about what's happening with your crops, with the amount of moisture, what's underground, what the quality of the soil is. Increasingly, you know, it's kind of like an iPhone. When iPhones and smartphones first came out, initially people didn't really think, well, why would you need that? Okay, maybe you can make phone calls, and why would you want internet on your phone anyway? But we didn't really have we didn't immediately tweak to all of the applications you can do with a phone. And now it's mind-blowing what you can do with a phone. I would say the same thing if you imagine lots of little phones and big phones. Well, eyes, ears, sensors, communication devices, put them all around Earth and around the moon and elsewhere in the solar system. And what can you do with those? There's a huge amount of applications for good and for bad, just like phones can be used for good and for bad. So they can be used to behave in ways that are not helpful to humanity, or they can be used in ways that is really, really helpful to humanity. So, for example, Norway's got a constellation of satellites that it's using, I don't know if it's one satellite or more, but they're using to map tropical forests and to track deforestation and things like that. Or you can use satellites to track human rights abuses. You can find concentration camps in China. There's all kinds of stuff. But then you can also use satellites to deliver bombs, you know. So there's every good thing and every bad thing can be helped with satellites.
Like almost every human activity.
Yes. Yeah. But it's something that we need to be aware of and conscious of, and I think the population of the world needs to be more aware of the both the very exciting possibilities, which is coming with the miniaturization of technology. So it becomes cheaper to launch. It just means you can put up a small satellite for quite a small amount of money. It's not just the province of Boeing and Airbus and Lockheed and NASA. You could do it as a small business person. But then we need to think about what the consequences of that will be. If we don't behave responsibly, then this fantastic resource, which is outer space, will these quite scarce and limited natural resources, which is the physical orbits that go around Earth and around the moon, could be ruined if we put too much debris in there, and maybe then all those benefits we won't get.
And when you say it wouldn't cost, you know, it's a small business owner could send up a satellite. I mean, what sort of cost are we talking about?
Well, you could, you know, build it yourself. People are making, you know, things like this big.
So 30 centimetres across.
Yeah, or smaller. Yeah, that's right. 30 centimetres across. Sorry, when I say this big, I'm forgetting that people are listening. Even smaller, but there is the authorities are discouraging the launch of really tiny things like the size of an iPhone, which is possible because they're hard to track. When they're hard to track, it's hard to figure out when you need to avoid one. How much would it cost? Maybe a million US to build it and launch it and do a whole program. It depends what you put on it. Go much cheaper. You can go much cheaper if you make it all yourself, and if you know you can get sometimes free or very cheap rideshare launches. So it's per kilo. I think Starlink. Elon Musk's largest launch vehicle that he's preparing. I think it's they're looking at $6,000 per kilo. So that could get down really, really. That's $6,000 a kilo. That's getting down really quite low.
Yeah. One of the things that really worries me about all these things being shot up into space is just how much fuel they're using, how much energy. I mean, is that a concern?
I think there's different kinds of fuels. Of course, there is a climate impact if you're using carbon-based fuels. There are some even more nefarious fuels that are cancer-producing, which if they end up, you know, getting debris all over the place, they can be very damaging and harmful to local populations. So some of that has happened in Russia and Kazakhstan because of the use of some of the toxic fuels in Russia and also in China. It remains to be seen. I don't know the comparison between, for example, how much carbon is emitted by the space industry compared to aviation. Whether they're, I would have thought aviation is just many, many, many times more. Perhaps not right at this very moment, but it's certainly the carbon impact is going to be, if the launches become very frequent, then that may be an issue. There are some quite innovative technologies coming about for launches, though, that don't involve carbon. There's one, for example, that is a catapult.
Wow.
And it just flings satellites into space. And it seems very unlikely that that would work. However, I have spoken to people who are in the know who say, no, actually, it's very viable. There's a company called Spin Launch, and their technology, you know, I've spoken to people who are have assessed the technology and believe it's very legitimate and could be done. So,
wow.
You know, I guess with that sort of technology, you're only going to be able to get so far out. But maybe if you fling it out and then you have a rocket that fires once it gets a certain distance out, that would be less carbon. I mean, the carbon wouldn't then be stuck on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, there's others that have looked at balloons. So just floating something up into the stratosphere and then firing a little rocket when you get up there, which might be more carbon friendly. I don't know.
It's a lot of innovation in any case.
There is a lot of innovation. Yeah, and once they get up there, they tend to use solar power for a lot of to keep the electronics going. But they need generally other forms of power to thrust themselves around. But there's some very innovative propulsion units being developed that are relying on plasma and, you know, electrons and, you know, just which I don't think produce any carbon emissions at all. But I don't think at the moment they would be sufficient to get off Earth. You'd have to use them as propulsion once you get to space.
Mm-hmm. Donna, I wanted to ask you now a bit more about 2 years ago you left Optus and you set up your own company. So just tell me about process and how that's been for you.
Oh, well, that's interesting. The reason I left is because most of the last 20 years, there wasn't really any space activity in Australia where I live other than Optus really. And then there was another government-owned telecommunications provider that came along. But at a certain point, it became clear that there were around 80 small space companies starting up, and they'd been calling me every now and then beforehand asking me for advice, a number of them. But it became clear that I either had to start my own firm so that I could actually properly legally advise them, or abandon the field to someone else who didn't know as much as I did. So really made up my mind for me. I just felt like the need was there and I had to do it. So having left my nice, stable employment, I found myself starting a small law firm. My husband's an academic, but he works together in the firm when he has time, and he certainly does a lot of the international and government advisory work. And so people, I guess because it's a small community, it wasn't hard to get. I was already quite well known in that community, and so the clients really found me. I didn't really have to go looking for them because they were already involved in doing space programs and hitting little roadblocks about how do we get a license to do this and how do we, you know, is this agreement okay to sign? So, I actually really love our clients because they are a lovely community that help each other a lot, and which creates some issues of conflict. If you're a lawyer, you'll know what I mean. Mm-hmm. managing conflicts between different clients when they're doing deals with each other has been one of the trickiest problems, but because they're all so lovely and well-meaning, it's been we've been able to manage it just by consent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what's it been like having your own business rather than working for an employer?
I think there's some great things and there's some hard things. I'm not someone who loves sending bills and doing the admin for it. I love doing the work, but I have to really force myself to get to do the. Some people love sending bills. I don't really like doing it. So I have to force myself to do all those admin-y type things and paying the taxes and so on. It is lovely having setting your own time. And then, of course, during COVID, everybody's been working at home anyway. So I guess everybody knows what it's like working at home and the various pros and cons of that. You can set your own timetable, and then the disadvantage is you can set your own timetable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Depends how disciplined you are. So, it tends to be, I tend to be motivated by needs of my clients. So once I realise they have a need, then I really get up moving and I'm firing on all cylinders until I get it done. But if it's not an immediate client need, then, it's equally possible to go to the beach.
the freedom of it, working at home.
Exactly. But it's been nice being able to get exercise and, spend time at home with my husband, and we do exercise together. We go to Pilates, we have coffee at a certain place, and it's you can get into a nice routine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure and most of your listeners are doing just that, working at home, getting coffees.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the company you set up is called Azimuth Advisory. Where did that name come from?
Yes. Oh, azimuth is a technical term used by space companies, but also it's also used in aviation and shipping, but it's a term that describes the direction, the way that you would find the direction to find your spacecraft or aircraft or ship. But it's a directional term, and I chose it because our clients would all know what it means, even though almost very few other people know what it means. But as soon as they see, as soon as our clients see my business card and they say, oh, it's a myth, they love it. So it appeals to them. It's confusing to most other people. But I have discovered that my hot tip for anyone starting a business is choose a name that's very short and easy to write down, because a short email address is of great benefit these days when you've just got to type it a million times a day.
And I like the fact that Azimuth as well is and perhaps for people who are listening to this podcast, a lot of the women I'm speaking to have really found their own direction. And so for me, that's a little bit of a symbol of also, looking for your own direction, looking at life.
Mm. And it's true, because during the time before I left, I was feeling like I was in a bit of a rut. I was in a good job that I enjoyed with nice people, and it was well paid. And it's very hard to find a reason to leave. And so, even though I was enjoying it, and I was, I was sending things into space. How fun is that? I've been doing it for 20 years, and so it was quite hard to find the thing that would motivate me to do something else. And for a long time I've been mulling over what should I do, and it never occurred to me until quite late in the piece to start a law firm. That was the last thing I would have wanted to do. But it was only when I saw this opportunity to do this, to be a quite unique and niche law firm that it started to be exciting. And at the end of the day, it's all about the people, really. It's because I knew all these people who needed me, and that's what made me want to help.
Yeah, so it's looking, you're filling and fulfilling a need that other people weren't able to fulfill. So.
Yes, that is that was the motivating factor. So, yes, I can earn some money from it, but, you know, I could probably, if I worked really hard, I could probably earn more money than I was getting from my other job. But, you know, if I take it kind of at a steady pace, it's probably a bit less, but overall it's a nice balance of a nice life, helping people I really like, doing some really fun and exciting work. And the other interesting thing is that I think probably everything I've done for the last 2 years, I've pretty much been the first person in Australia to do it.
Wow.
So pretty much everything I'm working on is absolutely cutting edge. And also I'm I really do feel like I'm the best person for that particular very strange niche job, because no one else, at least on my side of the planet, has really been doing it for 20 years the way I have. So it's, nobody knows how to do some of these things, but I feel like I'm the best qualified to have a crack.
And so that's incredibly exciting to be doing that.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, it's not very often that you find yourself, you know, working on moon missions and even human space flight things. And, you know, it'll be amazing when we start seeing some results. So we started to see it a little bit. One of our launch facilities has done its first couple of successful launches. We'll start to see. I think over the next few years we're going to see, I don't want to use the word explosion, but a plethora of interesting things happening.
Mm. Oh, incredibly exciting place to be working.
Yeah, no, it's good fun. Yeah. It's good fun. And I do, as I say, I love the clients I work with. I love being able to sit next to my husband and we work on stuff together, and he... we have some very complementary sets of knowledge as well.
Donna, I finish these interviews with two questions. And the first question is, in your career, has being a woman, has that ever been an issue?
I remember a moment when I was working in my previous role and going to the bathroom and looking in the mirror and being absolutely shocked that what I saw looking back was a woman, because I was so used to being in meetings with all men every day, and suddenly realizing, oh, that's what they're seeing. They're seeing a woman. You know, it's one of these really weird things that you spend all day inside your body looking out and you don't realize that people are looking at you. And so I'd kind of forgotten. It was almost like I had to do a double take. Like, oh, every time I walk into a room, they're going, oh, a woman's coming into the room. I wasn't really conscious of it. But the space industry has been, at least in Australia, quite male-dominated. There have certainly been some times when I felt like people were trying to use that as a way of excluding me. It helps if you're a lawyer, because you've got a professional reason to be there, and so you've kind of got something that props you up a little bit. You're not just relying on yourself. But you really do. I have really found that I've had to be an assertive person that backs herself. You definitely can't wait for someone to recognize that you have something to say. You just have to say it, and fortunately that's pretty much in my nature anyway. Mm-hmm. But I do want to just quickly mention a little aside. The cultural fact in Australia that space industry and engineering is not exclusively but very much dominated by men is not the case in all cultures. So a little while ago, my husband and I were doing some work in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, and we were working with the UAE Space Agency and dealing with a very senior and wonderful engineer who was in charge of, you know, the technical side at the space agency. A lot of them are women, and I remember asking her, so what's it like being an engineer in the UAE? And she said, a female engineer, and she said, oh, it's quite tough actually, because engineering is seen as a woman's job.
Amazing.
And then she said, oh, don't get me wrong, it's not that men can't be engineers, it's just that they really need to apply themselves. So that blew me away. And it turns out that that engineering in the United Arab Emirates, the engineering graduates at UAE University, for example, 60% are women.
That is amazing.
And it's not an anomaly. I was in talking to a Kuwaiti professor, engineering professor, and I said, oh, I'm just wondering how many of your students, the women, about 65% of graduates are women in Kuwait. So our perception, speaking as an Australian woman, our perception in Australia that engineering is kind of a boys' job, absolutely, culturally, we've imposed that on ourselves culturally. It is not true.
That is just amazing. And especially in countries where we tend to think of, you know, women's rights being
a real issue. Yeah, that's right. So I was speaking at a conference a little while ago, and I stood up and I told that story, and so I said to the 98% of men in front of me, if there's any man in the room that is thinking of a career in STEM, don't be discouraged. You just have to apply yourself. So they had a laugh.
Donna, the last question I ask is, if you had a message for the people who are listening, that message be?
I think from a more specific place in my work, I would like people to be more conscious of space of outer space as a fragile place and a place that deserves our protection and our consideration, because I think people don't realise day to day how important it is for life on Earth that we are able to use and continue to use space, and that it's not a great big rubbish tip where we can just throw stuff and it's so big that it all goes away. It's a fragile environment that we need to care for and look after.
Mm. No, it's a great message. So thank you so much, Donna. I mean, I think it's amazing how much of an expert you've become in space law. And I think it's as you say, it's so important for us to be aware of what's happening and make sure that, you know, we care for the Earth, we care for space, we care for, you know, the entire environment, not just the Earth.
We use space to look after the environment on Earth. And so if we mess it up, then no one will be able to use it. So It's important for that reason. But it's been a pleasure talking to you, Cecilia.
Yeah, well, indeed. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Brave New Women. On Friday, 22 January, I'll be holding a free webinar to talk about how women can stand up and speak up. There'll be two sessions, 8:30 a.m. in Paris, which is 6:30 p.m. in Sydney, and then the second session at 2:30 p.m. Paris, which is 8:30 a.m. on the US East Coast. If you'd like to join us, please connect on LinkedIn or on the Brave New Women Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening.